about how some guy in Vegas was able to take over someone else's electronic car because they got into the processing devices and could run it remotely. Every so often I'll watch interviews with these guys. They're very clever and just ever so slightly eccentrically crazy.
Yeah, as you say, well, people change and they improve and they use their skills for the better. So it's nothing really to complain about. It's really a positive aspect. Go ahead.
Yep, I agree entirely. You take the tools that you've developed and you try and use it for good. And, you know, we live in a capitalistic world where, for the most part, you could make a good living by doing that. So I much prefer people to use things for good than for bad. For every Unabomber, there's probably 1,000 kind of juvenile delinquent kids that grew out of it, thankfully. Well, Ivan, I think we've knocked this around as much as we could knock it around. I hope it kind of gave you some ideas of what might be going on with 220.
83 LP. Oh, yeah. And I can't thank you enough for that. It's just incredible how much insight one can get from just hearing, and no Wikipedia can bring to that. In terms of the comment that was actually striking a very compelling argument about the underpopulated 2 meters, 17 centimeters, why would anybody would want to hang out on 220? Well, for me, it's just, I'm new, so for me, everything is a kind of wow moment, and I'm like, what's this, what's that? And, yeah, that's a very compelling argument, but hopefully, the way I'm seeing it, the amateur radio, the hobby is picking up and experiencing probably, I don't know, renaissance, especially among younger generations. A lot of younger generations are picking up licenses right now, and especially millennials, incidentally, happen to be one. So hopefully we'll populate the 270 centimeters band, and we switch to 220. So far it's my favorite. I had a budget for my mobile rig, and I was shooting for ICOM and the big Holy Trinity type manufacturer. Fortunately, I actually settled on Anytone Tribander, only for the sole purpose, the reason, that it transmits on 220 with 25 watts of power, and it's a cheap $300 radio. Hey, I saved money, but I got what I wanted, so thank you again for all the insights and comments. 82 ALP.
Well, you're more than welcome, Ivan. More power to you. Anytone is a pretty good brand, in my humble opinion. I own ICOM and I own Anytone. Nowadays, if you have any kind of a hotspot and you're operating VMR, and you ask anyone on any of these thought groups what radio are they using to get into their hotspot, you have a very high probability of them telling you in any tone either an 878 or an 868. And I have an 878. It's a nice, solid piece of equipment, whereas Baofengs, if you've ever held one, they practically float away. They're pretty much a radio on a chip. They're very flimsy. So enjoy your Anytone. Have fun with it, and spread the word among your generation. We can use more hams. A lot of the growth of amateur radio recently kind of strikes me as more preparatory for Armageddon. You get a lot more people who just get a tech license and stick with that and are more interested in learning the nuances of storing dry food and water for some disaster yet to come. But I am gladdened by your entry into the hobby, and I hope it continues.
Yep, thank you very much. Prepper movement is on the rise, and I guess that has a lot to do with the current geopolitical situation. without getting into that, but I think that has a lot to do with that. Also, that 905, new edition of 905 ICOM thing that goes up to 10 gigahertz, I think, my opinion, it could be that they're releasing these products to general public right now so that it's part of a research and development program, sort of. Because once they, you know, a lot of stuff of HF propagation was actually discovered and contributed by hams. And perhaps that this is exactly what is the goal of, to find out or stumble upon something when there's so many people using it and experimenting with it. There's a good chance that we could stumble upon something that could be of interest, that kind of thing. So maybe not that bad of idea to, I'm sure there will be a good market for people who are interested in extreme high frequency propagation studies. So I'm personally not one of those people, but who knows?
Yeah, I agree with you. You never know how technology will advance. Again, it was my understanding when they first brought out the add-on to the modified 905 that it was purely a research project. They didn't really offer any suggestions of when it might come to market and if it might come to market. But again, my feeling is that it got such a positive review in the arena of amateur radio that they decided to take it commercial and see if they could make a profit out of it. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, there have been microwave guys for decades, but again, it used to be a very niche thing. It'll be interesting to see if it continues being niche or it widens out. I mean, amateur radio is an exploratory hobby. You have guys busy working on microwave technology, and someplace else you have, as Wes N2XJN mentions occasionally, people who are fascinated with the low frequency range, and loafers they're called by some people, and they're working on low frequency experimentation and studies. And so it's always interesting that, you know, the hobby is not kind of frozen in time. It's not like stamp collecting or coin collecting, where it's bits and pieces of the past. You know, we look backwards, we look down, and we look into the future. I think that's a good thing for a hobby to have as a feature.
I agree. I totally agree. KE2AOP.
Okay, very good, Ivan. Thank you for participating tonight in this. Next on our list is Rich, W2BZ.
Yeah, good evening, Roy, and everybody else. This is not ham radio related. It's about, as you probably already guessed, Roy, it's about a game called Flight Simulator 2020. And just to preface it, I am so not a gamer that I don't believe I've ever played a video game except maybe Pong in 1971 for 5 minutes. I was so against video games that I did not allow my children to play them growing up because I felt it was just a waste of time and just exercising your thumbs to me wasn't a great way to spend time. But I've always been interested in flying, so I started to investigate Flight Simulator, and boy, did I go over the edge of a cliff on YouTube, because apparently Flight Simulator 2020 is this amazing piece of software, but I mean amazing. And so I started investigating it. I sadly came to the conclusion to really take advantage of Flight Simulator. You needed about $2,500 worth of PC on the low end. $2,500 worth of PC to really get into Microsoft Flight Simulator. Let me let it drop. But as I was talking to Roy last night about it, I brought up, they have it for PC and they have it for Xbox. And because I'm not a gamer at all, I know nothing about Xbox, but now, a day later, I know a lot about Xbox. There are two new versions of Xbox called the Series X and the Series S, like Sierra. To make a long story short, you can get like 95% of a high-end PC flight simulator experience from a $257 Xbox console. You don't even need the Xbox X, which is about $500, to get into it. The S gets you 95% of the way there. So what I've learned just in the last 24 hours is these two new versions of Xbox are amazing pieces of technology paired with an amazing piece of software, and for like $350 you can have a very immersive experience if you're into flying. All of this I did not 24 hours ago about how these two new Xboxes are so fantastic. I don't know if there are any gamers out there, but if you know anything about it, please chime in. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Rich. I know we had a gamer on earlier on Echo Link. I don't see him there anymore, so he might have dropped off. If anyone has any comments, please feel free to hit that push to talk.
Sounds a heck of a lot cheaper than getting a plane.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Frank. It certainly is. Obviously, Microsoft does not suggest that this takes the place of flying or a proper flight simulator for the sake of being licensed to operate. So it's not recommended as a tool to kind of go around actual flight itself, but it certainly is a lot cheaper.
Yeah, the gas price is pretty easy on the wallet. They do use this in conjunction with flight schools. You know, learn procedures and lists and how to start up an airplane and all that.
That he spent about $16,000 in legal fees to fight the FAA
and a lot of different flight controls as add-ons. Some are very expensive. Some have, you know, rudders and throttles and yokes and all that. No, it's not a substitute for learning a real airplane, but it can familiarize yourself with the basics of flying. With Bing Maps in real time with the Xbox and a PC, if you're online, you could actually fly over your own house. That's how advanced this Flight 2020 is. And there's a company that built it for Microsoft called Asobo. I think that's the name of it, Asobo. And they just knocked it out of the park with this Flight Simulator 2020. Flight Simulator 2024 is coming out, I think, in the next 6-8 months. Probably for Christmas or something like that. Again, I'm not into it at all for gaming, but you can really take a deep dive into learning how to, let's say, start up a commercial airliner. Amazing stuff. Amazing technology. So that's all I report.
And how terrorists
can find out and do what they want to do. That's really smart. Unfortunately, and it's always good to ID yourself, unfortunately, there's a lot of ways of getting around it. If you remember, there were guys who took courses in flying without a license yet, who were terrorists, and they were, people took their money and taught them how to use planes. So I don't really think, or at least, you have to think in terms of, by the way, unfortunately, Frank was on EchoLink doubling with you, so I'm going to ask him to repeat himself. I heard what you said, and I just heard bits and pieces of what Frank was saying simultaneously, but just to touch back, Flight Simulator is a sophisticated simulation piece of software. It does tend to require a lot more effort than a general game. For the most part, most video games, you figure out how the controls work, and you're there. For Flight Simulator, which has been around historically for 40 years. It's the 40-year anniversary of Flight Simulator. It was written originally by a third party and bought by Microsoft and upgraded through the years. But you generally, it's recommended that you finish reading a reference work on flight that amounts to something like 800 pages. So it's not like you get Microsoft Flight Simulator loaded into the computer or the game device and you take off and fly a while in simple mode. I don't think there is a simple mode. So it requires a great deal of patience and time to accomplish anything. So as always, I hope you enjoy yourself, Rich. It sounds like it could be fun. Let me ask Frank to try and repeat what he said, because unfortunately, with you doubling with him, no one kind of heard it.
Yeah, WB2BXL here. Yeah, I was just kind of going back to the prior conversation and mentioning probably the one other contribution, and I'm sure people can debate endlessly whether it was a contribution or not. This is spending, by his own count, about $16,000 on a hearing to force the FCC to renew his amateur license after he got out of prison, which is kind of interesting. I was not aware that he just, at one time at least, the regs said that ex-offenders were not eligible for amateur licenses, but he apparently changed all that. Go ahead.
Okay, I was not familiar. I kind of faded on my recollections for Kevin Mitnick. He was a kind of important character in the 80s and the 90s, and then he kind of faded into a bit of obscurity. And I vaguely remember someone fighting to get their license returned to them after it was revoked, after they had been found guilty of a felony. I didn't have it connected to Kevin Mitnick, so that's of interest. I wonder if there's anyone else who actually had to do that as well.
WA2VSN with a comment.
Sure.
Hi, good evening, everybody. This is Stu, WA2VSN. Point of information, a moment or two ago, one of the OMs mentioned about terrorists could learn how to fly. Well, in fact, there were terrorists in 9/11 who actually went to flight school, and the United States government paid for their flight school. And what was interesting with the instructors is that these terrorist so-called pilots were not interested, per se, in landing an aircraft, but they knew how to navigate. So that was one thing. As a matter of fact, there was another one, a terrorist who wanted to learn how to fly a crop dusting plane so they could fill it up with anthrax and kill as many people as they wanted to. But I have to tell you, if anyone thinks that playing with Flight Simulator is akin to actual flight school, I went to flight school after college, and I've flown for many, many years. And nothing like getting into a Cessna 172 or Skyhawk and learning the theory of flight and navigation and communication and reading maps and flying an aircraft, it's you're never going to get nothing more than just a smidgen of what's involved, nor the pleasure of being in a flight deck, or as we used to call it, a cockpit, and flying an aircraft. It's something that people should try to do if they can.
Okay, thank you, Sue. The problem is it can get rather expensive, and I was sort of alluding to the 9/11 terrorists when I responded about how, you know, a piece of software is going to allow terrorists to wreak particularly havoc. There's a lot more sophisticated ways to wreak a lot more sophisticated havoc, unfortunately. And there's probably still no really good guidelines. I would assume that if you have enough cash, you can go to an aviation school and learn how to fly, you know, even if you don't have any anti-terrorist credentials on you.
Well, one thing for the very, very wealthy, you can actually buy a trainer, just as commercial pilots learn in a trainer, and some military pilots as well, or whether it's a change in avionics or anything else by manufacturers, they put a pilot into a trainer, and it moves up and down and sideways and pitches and yaws and rolls the whole bit, just like an aircraft. So there are actual trainers that are pretty darn good with displays that might have six or more LED displays hooked in tandem, together, whatever you want to call it, to show the actual view out of a cockpit. A lot of good things, but those things are terribly expensive. But nonetheless, it's very interesting. Years ago, when I first had interest in learning how to fly, Republic was advertising flight lessons for $5, you know, your first flight lesson. So it's a little bit more expensive right now, but it's certainly worth the price.
Yeah, but it's certainly gone excessively higher than $5 a throw.
Yeah, I have no doubt about that. Again, I know a lot of hams who also we flew together in various places. We flew to Bermuda a few times. I had one friend who had a twin-engine Cessna 310 that would make it to Bermuda very easily, so we flew that 310. It's just like anything else. If you want to have the experience and the pleasure, so you go ahead and buy it. There are people driving $30,000 cars and people driving $1 million cars. It's really up to you what you want to do in your life.
And it certainly is important how much money you have to play little games. I'm sure if $1 million cars you could get for $10,000, a lot of people would be running around with those $1 million effectively cars. But you know, most of us these days don't quite have the resources to go out and get a $3 or $5 million you know, tag Heuer, or you know, there's a whole bunch of others that make it very expensive cars. But I was curious about the correlation of amateur radio operators and pilots. There seems to be a degree of correlation between the two, and I've asked other ham/pilots why they think there's a slight preponderance of both hobbies in individuals. And so far, the best answer I've gotten from a ham pilot was that it's probably the tendency to like to be in control of the situation. Hams, he thought of, were in kind of control of the communications, and they were also in control of the transportation. I'm curious if you have any other type of insight of why you think there seems to be a correlation between the two hobbies among the population.
Okay, I hope I'm not preventing anybody else from coming on frequency. Well, K2QT Roger is also a pilot. I think he flew commercially. But you see, to me, when I was 12 years old, I studied Morse code and this and that. I became a ham radio operator at 15. And at 17, I was teaching adults electronic theory and Morse code. when you go into the cockpit or flight deck of an aircraft and you see the multitude, the multiplicity of gauges and what have you, and years ago they were all analog gauges, nowadays we call glass, they're all LED type gauges, the science involved is intriguing. It's absolutely intriguing to me, and so is amateur radio. So I think there was some commonality there. It's just not a question of control, but simply the fact that you're mastering a certain form of technology. And then the side benefit, of course, is you can go from point A to point B in the process. But you really have to know a great deal about navigation and instrumentation and light itself and what have you. It's awesome. It's an awesome hobby.
WTBC?
Yes, Rich.
I think there's a hard correlation because of what Stu was saying, because of the equipment in the cockpit, you know, with all the knobs and buttons and switches. I mean, we like that on our ham radios, and it's sort of the same feel, but multiply it, you know, by 100 times, and you get the cockpit of an airplane where just a couple of modules of the radios and the rest, you know, control navigation and everything else. It's really something. And Stu, if you want to have an eye-opener, go on YouTube and search for Flight Simulator 2020, because it's a brand new product and it's stunning what they've done. And there are add-ons, for instance, that you can make flight plans with, detailed flight plans from waypoint to waypoint to waypoint, just like you were making a flight plan, you know, in a real aircraft. If you haven't seen the new Flight Simulator 2020, you'll be amazed at what's there. A lot of pilots use it just for, you know, just for pleasure, just to, you know, be immersed in a cockpit situation. They have every cockpit from Cessna 172s to 747s and 767s, and it's become much more than a game that it was in the past. It's become a system, you know, it's become an environment. It's become a simulator. And there are pilots, there are, not pilots, but people out there, especially in Europe, that build panel by panel duplicate simulators, liners. They spend 10 years and a couple of $100,000, and in their basement, they're flying something that you couldn't tell the difference between an airliner and a simulator. So, just amazing. It's an amazing flying, I think, is very closely related in a lot of ways to ham radio.
Let me just make sure I have it. Yeah, I appreciate the heads up. To a great degree, I would agree with you, but simulation is simulation. And for a layperson, it may be the furthest that you could go along in terms of light, but there's nothing like getting into an aircraft and do your pre-flight check of the aircraft and then plan your route and you put it into the flight computer, figure out your weight and the wind, and you do all these various things before takeoff. And then finally, when you begin the takeoff of your aircraft and what have you, and you're en route, if you will, to your destination, being in the air is exciting, especially if you're flying at a low altitude VFR, you know, visual flight rules, where you see that which is below you. If you're flying in a commercial aircraft near 40,000 feet, you're not going to see anything whatsoever. And it's a matter of a computer and autopilot flying the aircraft, basically. But when you have visual flight rules, you're flying 7,500 feet, 1,000 feet, what's below you, and it's it's just a feeling that you can't recreate in any type of simulator. At least that's my feeling, and I think that's shared by most pilots as well.
Rich, you want to comment?
I was just taking a bite of a pear. Yeah, no, nobody says it's a substitute for real flying at all, but and the simulators that roll and yaw and pitch and vibrate and shake, there is one private simulator that does do that you can buy. I think the company's in the Netherlands, you know, for a few $100,000. But the amazing thing about flight simulators, they do have pre-checks and walk-arounds of the airplane. And it's as deep dive as you can get into anything that you could do at home, let's say, in a game. No other game comes close to how sophisticated flight simulator is. If you set it all to expert settings, you really have to know what you're doing to take off, let alone land. You really do know how to control. You have to control, you know, the mixture and you got to prime it, and you got to do all these things before you can even take off, and you have to learn how to do all these things. So it's Flight Simulator 2020 has been a complete overhaul of all the flight simulators before it, and it's been done by this studio that just does flight simulator, I think called Serbo, in conjunction with Microsoft. Microsoft didn't write Flight Simulator. It was this other company that did it, and that's why it's causing all this, garnering all this enthusiasm and interest, because it is so immersive, so immersive. And if I ever outgrow the Xbox version of it, then I will put in $2,500 to $3,000 into a PC to, you know, to be able to go all the way with it, with all the different add-ons, and it's just amazing. Stu, take a look on YouTube. You'll be in awe of what you see.
Okay, I certainly appreciate that. I'm going to ask you what I call a goof question. Now, where is the weight on an aircraft when the aircraft is on the ground?
Where did you say, where is the weight?
That's correct. Where is the weight of an aircraft while it's on the ground?
Depends on the aircraft, but I would assume it would be up front where the engine is.
The weight is on the wheels, correct?
What's the weight in that term? Yes, I thought you were talking more about weight and balance.
I'm not talking about weight distribution. Now tell me, where is the weight of the aircraft and its contents, be it cargo or passengers, when it's airborne?
On the wings?
I am so glad you said that. It's almost comical. Of course. Where else would it be?
Of course. You know, I could have got my, in college, for $300, soup to nuts, I could have gotten my private pilot's license. I'm talking about in the 60s. And I enrolled in the class, but after a week decided to do something else, probably go to a bar someplace. Boy, do I wish I went through with it. For $300, now I hear it's like $20,000.
I can't tell you what it costs now. I can only tell you what it costs then. But because you answered that question correctly, I hereby grant upon you, if that's English, a single-engine rating. Congratulations. Under the powers vested in me by the State of New York and the Federal Aviation Administration.
Go to Islip tomorrow, take a plane up, and do my first cross-country solo, because you said I could.
That's correct. Back to net control.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Rich. As always, I applaud your interest, Rich, and I'm sure you'll share your ongoing adventure. I hope you gain many, many hours of enjoyment, entertainment, and a bit of education, too, with Flight Simulator.
DDH with a comment.
Certainly, John.
To get to that original question, why ham radio and flight seem to be related, I think it's the practical application of areas of science that, with flying, you're seeing hard laws of science in demonstration, being vividly demonstrated for you. And same thing happens to a certain extent with ham radio, that you see laws of propagation and transmission lines are vividly demonstrated for us. I remember Dick always used to say, inside every ham radio operator is a scientist struggling to get out. Okay.
Yeah, I recall that as well. Let me just make sure I have the repeater. Okay. Yeah, I tend to think, though, there's kind of, unfortunately, there's two approaches to our hobby. One is somewhat utilitarian. The other is more intellectually curious. The intellectual curious are, I would imagine, the people sitting here and standing and doing whatever they're doing tonight, listening to this technical net, because the technical aspects of the world interest them. They're curious about them. Unfortunately, I've met the other group of people. People who tell me that they don't like to be called amateur radio operators because they took their credit card out of their wallet and ordered up something from HRO, and they arrived and they were capable of plugging the outlet in and plugging the antenna in and hitting the push-to-talk button. So they were obviously professionals. And other people that if you kind of ask them how they think a television works, they'll glibly tell you, you plug it in and you turn it on, and that's how it works. So there's a lot of other people out there that simply see the amateur radio as a means to an end of communication. Either the prepper people we talked about, a means of taking care of yourself in case of dire emergency, and the details of how it gets done is hopefully secondary, but probably tertiary or quaternary with them. So although I would like our community in general to be techno-nerds, since I'm one, I despair that a significant portion are not. They're just using a piece of equipment as we use a cell phone, or in the old days, even a slide rule.
Well, I think as time goes on, curiosity gets the better of them, and they start to want to dig into it a little bit. But this is, I guess, separates the individuals. Anyway, back to Ned.
Yeah, I hope you're right. I have met reasonably competent amateur radio operators who, if you mention the word antenna in a conversation, will basically break off because they don't want to talk technology at you. I hope that more people will wonder what makes the magic work. You know, every so often we joke that if you burn something out in your radio, you're letting the magic smoke escape. So I hope that people use this hobby as a means to have a better understanding of what really is going on in the world around us, rather than just giving it off to other people who are paid to deal with these issues.
Just a quick comment, and I'm going to sign.
Certainly so.
Thank you so much. One aspect of amateur radio that I pride myself, as do all of you, pride yourselves. Maybe I was 13, but I was self-taught Morse code, and I'm going to be 77 next month. And when my wife hears me in the radio shack and hears dits and da's and dots and dashes, it's amazing that those little sounds constitute a language. And I'm happy to say that I don't copy 25 words a minute any longer, but I think I'm definitely good at 20. And I've never lost code speed. And I think the fact that I was self-taught, as we all are, to learn ham radio, to learn Morse code, is interesting, because I've always been a linguist. I speak a few languages, and fortunately one of them is Spanish, so that helps out a great deal. But again, getting back to amateur radio, Morse code is such an incredible thing, especially when you're a young teenage boy. It's I don't know how else to describe it, but it's this cognitive power to learn and want to learn. And I think it's incredible. I could add that list of languages to the languages that I speak. And I think it's just incredible. I think there's a lot to amateur radio. We teach ourselves theory. And again, after I got my tech and my general as a teenager, I was teaching adults and I was giving the tech test to a lot of adults and what have you. And I think it's great. I think amateur radio operators have a lot to be proud of.
Well, I agree with you, Stu, and I'm very thankful for this hobby for many, many, many reasons. I basically learned the theory by sitting down with a copy of the ARRL handbook in high school and reading it from the first page to the last page. And I'm thankful I had the opportunity. I was always kind of curious. I was always the kid who took things apart, not necessarily at the beginning to put them back together, but took them apart to kind of figure out how they sort of worked. And I was always appreciative that I was in a situation where I could do that. There are, unfortunately, other fellow hobbyists that are less curious about these things. And I hope that eventually their curiosity is piqued by something and they discover something interesting. I don't know. It sort of depends on the individual. I mean, there's no such thing in my experience as the average ham. We come from all kinds of origins with all different kinds of motivations and options and plans. And it's sometimes we ourselves are unaware of the path that we eventually will end up deciding to take.
Well, I just think that this self-taught initiative that we all have, teaching ourselves electronic theory, what is a Colpitts oscillator? I haven't heard that since the 19th, teaching us Morse code. I recall that when I was a really young teenager, maybe 13, I bought an S-38E, a Hallcraft's receiver. I said, wow, this is amazing. Listening to Radio Moscow, all these other programs all over the world, and then I decided to get my novice. And I've always had a tremendous interest in radio. So there's a lot of good things that come out of this hobby. It's teaching yourself theory and knowledge and all these great things that let us grow from an intellectual standpoint. It's not like Citizens Band, where you go pay $99 for Lafayette Radio and you sit there and chat on 11 meters. I mean, amateur radio to me was a tremendous learning experience, or experiences in the plural, teaching me how to think, teaching me how to learn, teaching me what could I do with the curiosity to increase my learning out there and horizons. And I'm very, very thankful to be an amateur radio operator. Anyway, I want to thank you all for such a wonderful QSL. I have to get out of here. Have a wonderful night, everybody. Stay safe, stay healthy. Back to you, and this is Stu going QRT, WA2VSM. Good night.
Okay, Stu, 73. Thank you for participating. You kind of left me a little opening for one of my favorite stories, Colpitts oscillators. I remember the last time someone else kind of brought it up, not exactly in amateur radio land. In the 1970s, I used to be a regular listener to WOR and Gene Shepard. Gene Shepard was an amateur radio operator. He, for some reason, never actually operated using his first name, Gene. For whatever reason, he used his middle name, which was Parker. Nevertheless, he was a storyteller, and he had one particular story that he told on WOR in the 70s that I will always remember, of when he went down to the FCC office to take his written exam. And one of the written exam questions that he took, according to his story, was draw the schematic for a Colpitts oscillator and include values for the components. So that's my only recollection of the non-amateur radio world where Colpitts oscillators came up as a subject matter. But if you ever have the opportunity to pull some of the archives of Gene Shepard's stories, of course, he's the guy who wrote the Christmas story that is shown on television every Christmas time. So please avail yourself of Gene Parker Shepard's work. It was amazing. Anyway, any other comments on this before we close it and move on to the next subject?
Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah, sure, Stu.
Thank you. I want to share with you two things that I am incredibly proud to say that occurred during amateur radio. Number one, I spoke to the King Hussein of Jordan, and I have his QSL card. It's not every day that you speak to a king. I consider that quite incredible. Prior to him, it was Barry Goldwater, a person who was in the news, but speaking to a king of a country was quite nice. The thing that I'm most proud of is I was a member of Navy Mars, and when the Brooklyn Navy Yard closed, I met some interesting people. I got a lot of equipment, but I would get on 20 meters every afternoon when I came back from high school, and that was before submarines were nuclear. They were conventional subs, and they were actually permitted to transmit on amateur radio frequency. I spoke to a submarine coming back from near the Antarctic every single afternoon until it came back to whatever port it was in. And I ran auto patch to the Pentagon. And they would instruct me to make a collect call to Admiral R.E. Mickley in the Pentagon. And I did that for many, many, many weeks. I was ultimately invited by Rear Admiral R.E. Mickley to come to the Pentagon, and I got a tour of various areas in the Pentagon. 16-year-old kid. It was the most incredible experience of my life. I'll never, ever, ever forget that.
Okay, that's an incredible story, and you know, who knows how many great stories there are out there. I mean, every so often a guy will just kind of self-publish and collect his own little anecdotes. It's a shame that there isn't someone who kind of can gather together, you know, the best of stories like yours, and provide some source or website or what have you for them.
Yeah, I'm so sorry to dominate the queue here. One other quickie. Not too many years ago, there was a station in the Azores, and in my communications with this operator, he told me that he needed medicine desperately, and he couldn't get it in the Azores. I suggest he goes to Portugal. He couldn't do that. I actually obtained a great deal of life-saving medicine for this radio amateur operator in the Azores. And about a year ago, believe it or not, a year ago, I was talking to a station in the Azores. It was Santa Michael Island, the same island. And the operator said, "Are you Stuart, WA2VFM? And I said, "Yes." "Did you save my father's life? You sent him medicine that saved his life, and we never forgot you." It's just incredible. It's just incredible experience. I was on cloud nine when I heard that. They were thanking me 12 years later for that. I'll never forget that as well. Have a great night, because I have so many darn stories to say. Good night from WA2VFM.
Okay, very good, Sue. 73. You know, I mean, there'll be other Sunday nights and other opportunities to share your stories. So have a good, safe week. Be well, and we'll talk to you down the line, Sue.
you and I apologize for hogging the frequency. I really didn't mean to do so, but I'm so proud to share this with all of you. Good night, and thank you again. It's been a pleasure. WA2VFM.
Okay, very good. Well, Wesley, on to your non-amateur radio-related subject matter.
Thank you very much. How am I coming out?
Right now you sound fine, but in past experiences, unfortunately, that wasn't a constant thing. But I'm optimistic tonight.
Okay, just let me know when I'm not. Okay, so we have three subjects here, two related to Dexter, the British-English patient of facility, the university, and Rafin. For that, at the beginning, I need to come with the explanation what is Rafin. Autotroph of carbon consisting single layer of atoms, which is around like a hexagonal lattice nanostructure. So imagine that you have a fabric that is one atom thick. And if you have 100,000 of them stacked one on the top of the other, then you can create something that is as thick as human hair. Okay, so by weaving the graphene fibers into the fabric, we could create an integration of electronics into textile, because graphene is conductive. So when you touch it, it could keep it light or whatsoever. So the only limit are just our imagination, because it's super doable right now. So. By the way, graphene is the thinnest substance known to humanity till now. And there are a few ways of making the fabric. But the interesting thing is optical transparency of it. So if you think about invisibility, yes, it is doable. Right now, it's not going to be fooling the invisibility. It's going to be rather something like distorted light in some place. But the thing is that the fabric is so thin, so if you're wearing just the fabric made out of it, it may become in some places transparent to your nakedness or showing that you're naked. Okay, and all of the natural hair are so thick that everything is going to be exposed in the human body. So there is a technique called FLG, which is vapor deposition, and the other one is just liquid phase of extrapolated graphene. So, in other words, something is spraying you with it. And now you become partially invisible, but partially dressed. Okay, so how do you like it, Dr. Roy?
Well, I'm not quite sure. Your description is a little confusing to me. Graphene is an interesting piece of material. In the old days when we had science talks, there was usually at least one or two graphene stories a month. It's incredibly difficult to manufacture. It's very expensive, and it's very difficult to produce large swaths of it. You end up with small fragments, which have less impressive qualities. The monoatomic planar structure of graphene allows for electromagnetic waves to go through them, but they don't impart transparency on the wearer, so you're not going to get the outfit might be transparent, but you wearing the outfit just look naked. So I'm not quite sure. It sounds like the way you're describing it that it's an invisibility cloak, which, as far as I'm aware, it ain't.
That is correct. I'm trying to be quite compressed with the information so I can go to the next one before the space report time. But anyhow, it's the University of Exeter. They playing with any kind of material timing that they have, but anyhow. The next is artificial magnetic field for the space station. That will be probably our space expert area, but I want to give a few words about it. Problem explanation, strong solar storms and cosmic rays makes a great disturbances for equipment outside magnetosphere. So we have a Schumann waveguide, we have ERF, and then we have the beautiful plasma, right? Ionosphere, and then we go out of it. We are not covered any longer by the protection of it, and then we have a situation when strong solar storms are, I mean, they are minus 200 nano Tesla, but still strong enough to damage equipment on the spacecraft or International Space Station. And there is a quote sending solar storms during 1989-2003 were investigated, and they found a lot of equipment, space equipment, and astronauts outside of that magnetic field suffering from that. So I hope in this area we're going to have some additional feedback from our space expert. If we have him right now, listen. Looks like not.
Not sure of the question, Wesley. WS2N.
Okay. Influence of strong solar storms on the equipment on the International Space Station and the biological processes of living cells, but that biological process of living cells probably would be Dr. Roy professionals explanation. So I'm asking you, how do those storms affect, based on what I have in here, the protection space station in space missions and direction?
Okay, Wesley, there's constant damage occurring, whether there's a storm or not. Of course, it just increases when there's a storm. But, you know, they replace cameras because the charge couple, gets affected by these gamma rays and solar storm particles that are hitting it. And they've actually had to replace cameras. They've done it on spacewalks. They have spares up there. They actually replaced one camera with another spare. But, you know, stuff does happen. Yeah, satellites, of course, are always affected. If they know a solar storm is coming, sometimes they'll turn the satellites in such a way where it'd be diminished. They've actually lost satellites over the years due to damage from the solar storms. And I like to keep an eye on the NOAA has the good website. Put in NOAA, the K index. I like looking at that. which really shows the horizontal path of all the electrons and protons that are traveling from the North Pole to the South Pole, causing the Northern Lights. If you go to the NOAA site, they give you an up-to-date reading every for the last 3 hours. Let me drop it. 24 hours a day. In fact, they just had a solar